Thank you.
Next up is the State of Langland and Drown.
Please the court. My name is Cameron Kirkwood, and I'm here representing the appellant, Ms. Janelle Boone. I've requested 4 minutes of time for rebuttal. I guess to begin, I know the court spends a lot of time reviewing the briefings in these cases. There's a number of issues. I would definitely ask the court that if there are specific questions or issues that they would like for me to address, please let me know.
Experience tells me that we'll likely do that.
I will start out with the probable first issue that's going to be brought up by opposing counsel, the question of whether or not this was an issue that was decided in the prior appeal.
Let's start somewhere a little further back. When in the process of this case was the argument about an agreement as to all assets first asserted?
So in the initial trial, the agreement with regard to the assets was presented primarily as a way to trace funds. Clearly, there's substantial testimony and evidence presented at trial. The findings of facts after the trial indicate, without really any question, that there was this agreement to maintain the separate nature of
character. Let's parse that.
Okay.
There's a distinction between maintaining what was already separate and converting what was joint to separate. In your briefing, you only talk about maintaining. I could not find anywhere in your briefing or anywhere in the record ever where you made a claim that there was an agreement to convert what was joint property to separate property. Have I missed something?
No, Your Honor. You have not missed anything because our argument is that there was...
That's all I wanted to know in response to that answer. The wages that Mr. Langland was earning once the committed relationship existed were joint property under our case law. So something would have to take place to convert them to a different status. What did that?
The monthly agreement did that.
Okay, and when was the monthly agreement first asserted as converting joint to separate property, since we've already established that all you've ever argued was that people agreed to maintain separate as separate, never to convert?
The argument was presented to the court when this matter was remanded after the first appeal that...
Isn't that too late?
No, Your Honor, because it was initially presented as a way to confirm the separate nature of property, to confirm that throughout the entire relationship
now
they didn't
just
have...
said again, confirm the separate nature of property. Mm-hmm. You first have to get from joint to separate. I'm still not understanding how that happens.
How the property is...
What is joint property becomes separate property. Mr. Langland, when he earned money, that was joint property until there was something that changed its status.
Correct. So there's two things on that. Number one, I would say that the monthly agreement prevented there from ever being joint property. I acknowledge that the presentation of that to the trial court was made in a direct contractual, the direct contractual argument after the first appeal determined that the way we had approached it before was not the proper way to approach it. It was remanded to the trial court to reconsider these issues, and we...
All right, now let's assume that's true. The trial court at the second round in its amended findings found that Ms. Drown did not make a knowing and intelligent waiver of a right with respect to joint property. What evidence is there in the record that would tell us that the trial court was wrong about that, and why isn't there substantial evidence in the record to support that?
There is substantial evidence in the record to support the opposite of what was said by the trial court.
Okay, well, that's not our test. Our test is there also substantial evidence to support what the trial court did find.
No, there's no evidence to support what the trial court did find.
What evidence is there in the record that Ms. Drown was ever told that this property was joint property until and unless she agreed otherwise?
I don't believe that that's the test under...
Well, why don't you just indulge me and answer my question?
Okay.
What evidence is there?
That she was ever told?
Right.
She had as much information and knowledge about that as Mr. Langland had.
Well, that may mean zero.
Perhaps neither one of them had that specific knowledge.
If you look at the case law on prenuptial agreements, which is a good place for us to look here, I think, there has to be a disclosure of what your rights are and a knowing and intelligent waiver of those rights after you've been told what they are. Is there any evidence in this record that Ms. Drown was ever told, if you don't agree this is separate, it will be joint?
You don't even get to that point if the agreement is substantively fair, which this agreement was. If you look at the case...
Okay, there's no finding that she was ever told and no evidence that she was ever told that she should seek independent legal advice. Given that, how can you say it's substantively fair?
That would go to procedural fairness, Your Honor.
Oh, you're saying this is substantively fair?
Certainly. They entered into this agreement from the very beginning of their relationship, exactly like the couple in GWF.
Is that the test for substantive fairness, that they started with this agreement?
That's what they said in GWF, Your Honor, is that they entered into this agreement with knowledge that they were going to share everything equally. They spent their entire life together doing exactly that.
And that's all you need for substantive fairness?
That was an affirmation that... They, throughout the course of their relationship, felt that this was a substantively fair agreement to split all the property equally.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Doug Shepherd for Sharon Drown. I mistakenly told the court on Langland 1, if they entered the decision that they entered, that would likely take care of this case, but it didn't. So I'm going to begin with our appeal first. Under Rule 12.8, after the court decided that the properties were joint properties, the court has to enter orders that allows us to get the benefit of the appeal, and we went back. I naively believe the $101,000 was still in the court. It came as a surprise.
Can you help me out a little bit on the facts here? Because as I understand it, there was some money, maybe it's $101,000, in the registry of the court. There was a motion to establish fees and order the clerk to disperse money to pay those fees. Pleadings were presented to the judge that had one number in them, and the judge didn't accept that number. That number was $98,035.80. Instead, awarded $70,000. In making corrections to the proposed pleading, the court appears to have made a mistake and failed to line out and correct one of those numbers. Later, a judgment was entered for $70,000, but the clerk sent $98,000 to Helsel Fetterman. Did the Helsel Fetterman firm ever remit the difference between $70,000 and the $98,000 back to the court?
Actually, Helsel Fetterman got $101,000, and he never said a word to the court or to us.
How did they get $101,000? Because the biggest number I could find was $98,035.
Well, the order that I objected to and said was nothing like what was recorded in the court said that the clerk of the court should give all money in the account to Helsel Fetterman, not $98,000, not $70,000, but all money in the account. If the court looked at the record, I was fairly frustrated about the order that was going in, but I understood that the supersedious for all of those orders would be decided later. But the order directed the clerk to give them all the funds, and so 2 days before our hearing on the supersedious bond, somebody from Helsel Fetterman went there and had to check the clerk give them all $101,000, even though the attorney's fees was for $70,000, and even though it was 2 days later that we were arguing the supersedious bond, and we're all the way up to the Court of Appeals in Langland 1 with June 12th of 2012 with pleadings where Helsel Fetterman saying it's not fair that they can't get any of those funds out of the court based upon the $683 Nobody said a word till the findings of facts got changed to where we were supposed to get $66,866, and there was no money in the court. At that point is when I went back, and the purpose of our appeal is to get a judgment for the $66,866. Have I answered your question, Your Honor?
Well, I have one more. There was an order granting motion for attorney's fees, costs, and granting other post-trial motions. And that order says the clerk is authorized and directed to distribute from the court registry $98,000. There's another order before that that says they get all of the money?
That's the same order.
It's the same order.
It's the same order. The language, it's where they cross out the 70 sometimes, it didn't cross out the 98, and part of the order said they were directed to give it all. And I thought after that hearing there was an agreement from Hassel Fetterman that we would address the supersedition.
I don't care about separate. Yeah.
It's in that, I believe it's in
this
that
order. This is the order.
Yeah. I was handed that order after I was surprised by losing the hearing and told the judge that.
I believe there's a phrase that's $70,000 or so much as is available in the account.
Yeah.
Well, that would suggest to me, when I read it, that if there wasn't 70, you got up to 70.
Absolutely.
So I'm not reading that to get to 101.
Clearly it was not intended that they would get 101. Clearly it was not intended they would get 98. Clearly they are not purchasers in good faith. Why this was not disclosed during all of the hearings and during Langland 1 before this court, that the money had already been taken and all of this apparently was irrelevant, is beyond me. But I've never quite seen anything like it. I was somewhat frustrated. I'm sure the judge didn't know what to do. I don't know why a judgment was not entered against Boone.
As I understand it, a remand, the court rejected your effort to get it back on the basis that you hadn't objected to the fee award. Is that, in fact, true? And if so, was that because in the posture of the case at that point, they were a prevailing party or entitled to be?
Well, I didn't supersede the judgment on the attorney's fees for $70,000. I believe I superseded everything else. The language was not probably as clear as I'd want to be, but clearly Hassel Fetterman believed that because they took it up to the Court of Appeals and argued that it had superseded everything and it wasn't fair in their motion objecting to the supersedious decision in the Court of Appeals in Langland 1. They said the decision below on October 25th, 2011, the trial court entered an order staying enforcement of the trial court's May 26th findings of facts, concluded the law, decree, and order, and then they addressed below that. That included the order entered on August 12th of 2011, and including the attorney's fees, and then it said it's unfair and contrary to appellant rules to stay enforcement of all of these orders based upon the 683. That's what they argued, and the commissioner said, if you don't think it's fair, go back to the trial court. The idea that they already had all the money when they were making those arguments in front of Division One and in front of, I had no idea that it happened.
So are you suggesting there was a lack of candor to the appellate court?
I want to be careful I say this. I allege that there was a fraud on the Superior Court and on the appellate court by Hassel Fetterman. And to argue now that they're good faith purchasers, they actually, in their application for attorney's fees, said we're not asking for any as representation of the estate. And then when we got back to the Court of Appeal, the trial court, they said, excuse me, we can take it from the estate first because we were representing the estate. It's, these funds were supposed to be in the estate. So we get to keep the funds because we earned them all as the attorney for the estate. And I filed, and I hope the court has seen it, clerk's papers 363 and 366, that's a bold-faced misrepresentation, and I'm being generous when I say that, as to what occurred in this case. So we're asking for a judgment for $66,866.09 against Janelle Boone and Hassel Fetterman in interest pleas at 12%. If you leave it up to the trial court to determine what the interest is, I think the trial court will do 12%. It'll be appealed again by Hassel Fetterman as abuse of discretion. I think you can instruct the trial court on what the interest rate should be.
Well, I take it you made the same argument to the trial court that they had perpetuated a fraud in the trial court and on us, and I take it you waived our previous opinion saying we vacated the attorney's fees. So what did Judge Urich say was the reason he was unimpressed with the argument?
He never said a word about why he didn't enter the judgment, either against Janelle Boone or against Hassel Fetterman. Never said a word. If I was to speculate,
We don't need to have a speculation.
Yeah, I mean, I never said a word about why he wouldn't
do it. So there is nothing in the record.
Nothing in the record.
I missed it.
Not a thing in the record why he wouldn't comply with Rule 12.8 and give us restitution of our funds. Not a word. The order is just send blank. Thank you.
I'd like to direct the court's attention to the November 17, 2014 order that explains...
17 what?
November 17, 2014 order. It's course papers 2076. And the findings of fact explain exactly why the court entered the orders it did. Two things here.
When we vacated the award of attorney's fees, why wasn't the money returned to the court writers?
Two things. We're talking about two different...
You're talking about two different things. We're talking about one thing. Court's order awarding attorney's fees was reversed by this court on the first appeal.
Certainly. The order that was... There was two different orders with regard to fees. There was one that was an approval of payment of fees to Helsel Fetterman as part of administration of the estate.
But you didn't represent the estate.
No, we represented the interests of the estate. And there are two letters... in the record that demonstrate that we conferred with the administrator of the estate, said, look, these are issues that we need to address. We need to defend the estate's interests against these claims from Ms. Drown, and we're going to do that with your permission. They said, yeah, that's fine. We're not going to make any decision. You know, we just don't want you to come back around on us for not doing it. And that actually is in the record, and I apologize it was not cited to in my brief. But the letter from confirming this conversation from Mr. Olver to Mr. Henson is 2015.
Why should Helsel Fetterman get to keep the money now?
Because it was an administrative cost of the estate. There's no reason. This is
well,
a similar...
this really was a fight between two people over who got the estate, wasn't it?
Certainly. And there.
Okay, and why should one get to keep the spoils when she lost the fight?
Because the that doesn't just because she ended up losing part of the fight, she didn't lose
she
all the
most
fight.
Of it.
Well, there were some claims that were obvious that were
if,
clearly
if we
overruled.
If put this on a ledger, you would be hard pressed to say you got more money than she did.
At the end of the day,
unless you get to keep the fees.
At the end of the day, she represented the estate. If okay, Mr. Langland had been alive,
answer my question.
Okay,
you've agreed this is really a fight between two people over who gets what's in the estate.
It is a fight over...
It was not a fight over the, for example, the estate trying to get something for the benefit of the decedent's heirs from a third party.
This is the same situation as if the couple had broken up. Mr. Langland would have had every right in the world to defend himself against claims coming from Ms. Drown. This is his
and
money, and he had the right to do what he wanted to do with it.
For fees, we would use need and ability to pay, and it would not be an equitable result that left one party destitute because the other one finessed the game, which is what appears to have happened here. This seems like a really unfair result. Ms. Drown appeals the decision. She reverses the attorney's fees. She goes back to get what she thinks she's won, and she finds out it's already been spent by paying Helsel Fetterman, her opponent's attorney.
Those were fees. Those were estate assets.
Tell me why that's fair as opposed to giving me a technical legal argument. Probate is an equitable proceeding.
Certainly. It is fair because every estate, every entity has a right to defend itself against claims of other parties. Regardless of where those claims come from, it had a right. He had a right. Langland had a right to say where his assets went. He and Janelle...
Your client was not qualified to serve as the personal administrator because of a conflict. She was removed and someone else was appointed, and this fight then took place.
She was then reinstated.
Not till after the fight was over and the court had ruled who won.
She presented her fees to the court. The court specifically approved her fees in that August 12th order, $498,000. Then they issued a judgment against Drown to reimburse the estate. The payment went from the estate to Boone's attorneys.
Your time's expired. And then I'm very skeptical of your argument.